Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward High School for Girls, where I speak to old Eds who've gone and done wonderful careers having crossed Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. My name is Ben Anderson. I left school and went to Warwick University and ended up working in the UK's radio industry, first of all as a producer, then as a managing editor for three radio stations in the north. I now run a podcast production company, Sound Rebel, and I love producing this podcast for school because some of the conversations I have, well, you never quite know where they're going to go. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jules Park Robinson. And before I say hello, Jules, I'm sorry if I get a bit giddy today, because your CV is so cool. You left school and went to Aberystwyth University. You then joined the Royal Military Police. You were there for 21 years, where you became commanding officer of the Special Investigations Branch. You're now the global head of special investigations at GSK Consumer Healthcare. It reads like you're the lead character in the latest Netflix true crime drama. It's such a cool career. Jules, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Where do we start? You know, I think I've got so many questions about your career and what you do now. And of course, your work with the Royal Military Police as well. We will be talking about another role that you have later on. You are the chair of British Wheelchair Basketball. Of course, the Commonwealth Games is coming to Birmingham later on this year. So we'll talk about that too. But before we get into all of that, let's take it right back to the start. You left school in 1993.
Correct.
What was King Edward's High School like back end of the 80s, start of the 90s?
That's making me feel really old already because you just mentioned those dates. So school was great. I was there with my two sisters. I had an older sister and a younger sister, so sort of followed them through. It was busy. I lived in Solihull, so it was a bus ride across to Edgbaston, threw ourselves into everything extracurricular. It goes without saying that obviously as a school environment, it was really strong academically. That wasn't necessarily my forte, unlike my two sisters. So I was always, you know, not top of the class and not expecting to be top of the class. And so I took my opportunities really to grow and to shine outside the classroom, mostly sport, but a lot of music as well. So some really fond memories from that time, and also some sort of long lasting impact in terms of what I'm doing now and how it sort of shaped my career going forward.
And what was Birmingham like at the time? Did you go out much?
Yes. Don't tell my mother, though. She might listen to this podcast. We did. But then it's interesting now. I mean, I've got an 11-year-old daughter and it makes me sort of literally shiver when I think of some of the things that we did. But then, of course, this is pre-mobile phones. So, you know, my parents used to give me sort of, I had an emergency cash to reverse, you know, the charges and stuff in the telephone box if I got stuck places. But there were a number of times where they sort of dug me out of a hole and came to collect me from Digbeth and some unusual places where we went out, particularly sort of in the sixth form. And we used to head across into the university, into the students' union bar, not to drink, I hasten to add, but, you know, to play the occasional game of pool when I'm sure that we weren't supposed to be doing that. So, but it was fun.
And what was it like being a woman in the 90s, like a young woman in the 90s? Because I was doing an interview last week with somebody to do another podcast that I produce about giving up alcohol. And they were talking about how the 90s for them as a woman, it was almost, you know, they wanted to go out. They wanted to party, to kind of say, look, we can do this as well as you can, blokes. You know, it was the ladette culture, wasn't it, in the early 90s? The Zoe Balls and the Sarah Coxes, yeah, drinking pints and pictured in the newspaper.
Yeah, totally. And I think because I was heavily involved in sport, both inside and outside of school, it was very much, you know, anything you can do, I can do as well, if not better. And so there was very much that drive to sort of to have equality. And actually, if you're going to go out, I'm going to go out. And, you know, I later in my sort of playing career, once I got to university, started playing rugby. And so that changed the dynamic again of, you know, that culture and what it meant. It's very different now, obviously, but at the time it was, you know, your pints of beer as opposed to gin and tonic. But yeah, spent a lot of time in the sixth form, certainly sort of wanting to prove that we could do everything just as the boys could do.
And did you know at school that you wanted to go into the military, that you wanted a military career?
Once I was about 14, 15, yes. Yeah. So my sister was 2 years older than me. So we'd gone to a careers fair when she'd sort of started her A-levels and was trying to decide what she was going to do. And my uncle had been in the Navy, but I had no other military connections at all. But going around this careers fair, I came across the sort of armed forces recruiting stand and was literally sucked into it there and then. I always knew that I wanted to have a job that didn't involve sitting behind a desk, which is laughable because obviously now that's clearly what I do. But it took a long time to get there. And I loved the outdoors. So I wanted to have something that was dynamic. It was exciting, that would take me to different places, that was physical. And so I knew from that really early age. And then I was, you know, when we were talking to these recruiters, they said, well, there's an opportunity that you can apply for a sixth form scholarship. And I wasn't going to fly because my eyesight wasn't good enough. I wasn't too keen on the sea. So the army was the sort of the best option and certainly the one that would sort of grabbed my attention. And clearly, you know, when you're at a fee-paying school, if there's an opportunity to get some additional support with that, then why wouldn't I? So I was really fortunate. I went through that assessment process when I was 15 and was successful and awarded a place at Sandhurst, which I was able to then take any time up to the age of 25. So I did drag it out a little bit. If I think about it now, I'm not sure at 16 anybody knows what they want to do for the rest of their life, but I was adamant that's what I wanted to do and it stood me in good stead for a good 20 years. So yeah, I went back to school and told them that that's what I've done, and interesting reactions because it was unusual. I was an anomaly. So I was lucky. There was myself and a very good friend of mine who had decided that she wanted to join the Royal Air Force at the same time. So we were sort of like partners in crime, but we were unusual. And I don't think necessarily all of the members of the staff really kind of knew how to handle that because we weren't following the traditional careers for, you know, academic young women at that time, which was, you know, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. No, I'm going to join the army.
Was it unusual because of it being a career that not many people had done from the school before? Or do you feel like because you were a woman, it was seen as unusual?
I think it was both. And it was the two together, which was just, you know, that mix of, you know, I don't recall any other girls from the school having previously gone on to do that. And I think, you know, this was a school for young ladies, let's be honest. That's the, you know, the environment and that we were in at that point. And I wouldn't say that it was narrow-minded, but, you know, at the time, you know, the headmistress, for example, fabulous woman, but was a Quaker, and that faith is, you know, pacifism is really important to that faith. So the idea that one of the students was going to go and join the British Army was something that was quite difficult to sort of comprehend. So I think, yeah, I would like to think that though in hindsight, that's quite trailblazing. And I know that that wouldn't be the reaction now. Things have come a long way in 20, 30 years.
Well, quite. But I mean, it's even, you know, looking at society as a whole. I remember the adverts for the army. It was always blokes, young men, going and being the best, I think was the tagline. It might still be. But, you know, it was men join the army. That was the narrative, wasn't it? That men join the army. And so actually you were a trailblazer at that time, because now you look at, I mean, I know it's a really silly thing to say, but you look at the adverts, but I suppose that's the kind of the recruiting adverts you see all the time. And now it is a good gender balance. It's a good race balance as well. When you look at those adverts, it's not just young white British men going to join the British Army.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's quite interesting as well. You know, you often hear particular, conscious it's International Women's Day tomorrow, talk about gender equality. You hear a lot of people say, you've got to see it to be it. And I strongly disagree with that as a concept, because otherwise no one would be the first to do anything, would they? You would never break a ceiling because you wouldn't know it was there. So I think that, you know, someone has to be the first. And actually, you know, if that's me in a certain scenario, then great. You know, if I can then pave the way for others to follow, then I think that's a really positive thing.
And when you joined the army, so what was the timeline then? Was it Aberystwyth and then Sandhurst?
Yeah, so I went to Aberystwyth and I didn't sort of take a gap year, but I decided, so volunteering was always something, and that started from school actually. When we were at school in the sixth form, we used to spend Friday afternoons and we used to do things in the local community, and I used to go and visit these two elderly ladies. And, you know, that sort of idea of helping others really stuck with me. So I did 2 years at Aberystwyth and then decided to take a gap year in the middle of my course, which was quite unusual. So I worked for Oxfam and came back actually to Birmingham to do that. I had to go home and live with mum and dad, which because I was a volunteer and not earning any money. But I did that for a year and then went back to Aberystwyth and did my final year. But at that stage, I discovered rugby. So I played a lot of hockey at school and then I went to university, and the hockey culture and environment wasn't something that I felt particularly comfortable with. It was quite elitist. And so a friend of mine said, oh, you know, you should go and try rugby. I'd been born in Abergavenny. So I was then found myself obviously back at Wales at university, and very quickly, right place, right time, got selected to play for Welsh students and then selected to play for Wales, which meant that then I had this opportunity and this dilemma where I was supposed to graduate and go to Sandhurst, but it was the same, or the following year was the Rugby World Cup. And so I tried to work out how I could delay my entry into Sandhurst to be able to play in the World Cup. So obviously the solution was, we'll stay at university for another year and do a master's degree. So I stayed in Aberystwyth for an additional year so that I could every weekend drive down to Cardiff and carry on training and playing.
Before we move on I'd love to find out what it was like to join Sandhurst and, you know, go. It's almost a mythical place, Sandhurst. I'd love to kind of just banish some of those myths, find out what it's really like. But before we do, was it frustrating for you? You know, you're obviously an excellent, were, I don't know if you still play rugby these days.
Oh, I'm a little bit old, but thank you.
Were obviously an excellent rugby player. You wanted this career in the military. Was it frustrating being a, you know, girl in the girls' school and looking across the drive and seeing that the boys were playing rugby and seeing that they were doing CCF on a Friday afternoon and that those options weren't available to you?
I think CCF, yes. I think rugby, I hadn't discovered it yet. I think if you fast forward 5-10 years, then yes, absolutely. You know, and for the summer sports, you know, it was tennis or rounders. And, you know, I would love to think now that hopefully maybe the girls have the opportunity to play cricket, for example. So I think at the time it didn't really occur to me. But if it was my daughter now, then I really hope that our eyes have been opened up to how we increase those opportunities and actually how, you know, you've got such a unique environment there where you have boys and girls schools next to each other with shared facilities. And that creates such a wealth of opportunity to do things and collaborate and offer more options. So whether that be sport, music, and it was massively, you know, at the time when I was at school, certainly music was and drama were the two things that were really, really closely integrated. But I think those opportunities to improve the offerings for sport, for example, you know, and, you know, a wider choice of A-level subjects, for example, there's all sorts of things that you can do there with having that shared site.
So how hardcore is Sandhurst?
Well, I think the thing is, you have to. So I was really lucky because I went back as an instructor, which was one of my best jobs in the army. I absolutely loved it. And actually, having been a cadet there, it's the one job that I really wanted to do, was to go back and instruct. So you know that a lot of it is, or certainly the first few weeks, if you understand what they're trying to do, then it makes it easier to swallow. So you know that they're trying to break down all of your barriers and then rebuild you in a way that, or mold you into a way that is suitable for moving forward. There are elements of it that physically and mentally really challenging, but I think what it gave me was the best leadership training in the world, and how that has then allowed me to translate that learning into now a civilian and corporate career. You can't buy that. So it was a wonderful opportunity.
And what is it that makes it the best in the world? I mean, just very quickly, it sounds like, you know, once you accept that you are going to be broken here, both physically and mentally, I can't quite work out how that will then make it easier. you expect that you are going to be broken by this experience. But I suppose it's what you're saying is that you understand why they want to do that. And it's because they have for many, many years, they have trained leaders and they know. What is it that makes it the best?
So it's things like knowing that, okay, we're going to go away and we're going to be on this exercise for a number of days, and that you're going to be progressively sleep deprived. So what are they trying to do by that? They're trying to see how you cope and you function under pressure and in challenging circumstances. Or when you get to the end of a run and you think, you know, you're heading back towards the gym and that's great, or we're nearly at the end, and then they take you on another mile loop around the lake. You know, it's that ambiguity, it's that unknown, and then how you react to that. And it's a tried and tested model. You know, they teach you the way to analyze problems, and they use a number of different settings to do that. And I think it has the best instructors. It has a huge amount of input, and it has a good sort of education and training element that's attached to it as well. You do a lot of history and strategic studies and politics, and you use that learning. So it's that blend of the physical, the academic, the mental, and then sort of that scenario planning and testing that in different environments, which means that you come out the other end of it a really sort of accomplished leader, or certainly knowing how you would tackle the unknown. And I think that's the key thing. You're never going to have all the answers, but you have a methodology which allows you to apply that to any given situation.
If you come out the other end of it.
True. Not everybody does. Yeah. Yeah.
When you went there, was it just from that the perspective of being a woman doing this training, was that still something that was obvious? You know, you were a female cadet, there were female cadets and there were male cadets, or were there just cadets at the time you get to Sandhurst?
Well, when I went through, we were separate but together. So we had, you know, within one company, we would have three different platoons. One would be female and two would be male. Now what they do is from day one, they integrate everybody. So within your sort of team environment, your platoon environment, you may have, you know, three or four female cadets and the rest will be male. And, you know, there's pros and cons for both ways of doing it. And actually now, a lot of the time when they're on doing drill, for example, or on parade, they might be wearing trousers where we had to wear these god-awful skirts and shoes. And it's nothing worse than, you know, having 30 women in a changing room and you just got out the swimming pool and then you're suddenly having to put, you know, tights and shoes back on. It's just horrific. But, you know, now we've just only recently had combat uniform that has been designed for women. So, you know, it's shorter in the body. It may be narrow at the waist. It's, you know, different length of leg and in the back. So it's taken a long time to get there, but we have now made that progression. I think when I was there, I wouldn't say we necessarily were treated differently, but I think it also gives you a distinct advantage as a woman. And it's the same when I went to Staff College later on. I remember saying to somebody afterwards, we're really lucky because there's only 10 girls on this course. And they said, well, why is that, you know, a positive? It's like, because everyone remember who we are because we're in the minority. You know, I'm the only female and I'm the only military police on this particular course. So when anyone's got a problem, they're going to ring me. Whereas in a sea of, you know, 200 men, with all due respect, when they stick their berries on, they all kind of lots of them look the same. And unless there's a particular skill set or experience that stands out, which is something that I need to connect with, then a lot of them just can quite often, you know, they don't have that uniqueness about them. So it's about how you use that to your advantage is what I'm really trying to say.
It's interesting that that's the perspective. You used it to, you recognized that and you used that to your advantage. I mean, it's bonkers, isn't it, that it's only very recently that uniform change that you just talked about. And am I right in thinking it was only in the last few years that restrictions were lifted on where women could serve as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a big project in terms of women in ground close combat, and now all the roles are available to women. And, you know, that's still for many people a source of debate. I was quite clear when I went to Sandhurst that, you know, I had some different ideas about where I might want to go. And the military police stood out for me because for many roles that sit within the army, you will train and train and train for a role that you may never get to do in anger. Now, for a lot of people, they say, well, that's a good thing. But actually, if you've chosen this profession, then you would be learning skills that you want to put to good use. But for me, joining the military police, it was very important that we have a daytime, peacetime role, as well as a role on operations. And so there was nothing that was going to be surplus to requirements that I was going to learn. I was always going to be able to use those skills, whether that be in barracks or then overseas.
I feel like this is where the Netflix show starts. It's when you join the military police. So what happens at the end then? So you go to Sandhurst, and is it like, I don't know, like options for university or whatever? Do you kind of choose? Do you rank? Do you go, I'd love to be military police number one, I'd love to do this number two, number three?
You go through a selection process. So during the middle term, essentially you have another number of options that you can put down, and then you go for selection interviews and you get offered a place in your sort of chosen cap badge. And I was fortunate to go to the military police, which was where I wanted to go, and left Sandhurst and then pretty much straight out to Poland on exercise and then to Kosovo. So it really was sort of baptism of fire. And I, you know, I had 21 years of going to interesting and challenging places and seeing lots of different things. So it really was a rewarding career.
Well, you ended up commanding officer of the Special Investigations Branch. Was that always the aim when you joined? I always like to ask this because I think that it kind of relates back to school, where a lot of people say it's almost instilled when you're in that school that whatever you do, it doesn't matter what you do, but whatever you do, try and be the best at it.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, that never giving up on your goals and your ambitions and always, you know, sort of trying to increase that potential and where next, where next, where next. That's a strength, but it can also be a weakness as well, because, you know, you're never necessarily quite fulfilled. It's like, well, you're always looking for that next opportunity. So I think when I joined, I was fairly set that I was going to be career military. I was going to stay till I was 55, which is the normal sort of retirement age. And that was always what I was going to do. And then when I got to the point where I commanded my own regiment and I had 350 soldiers, and it was a huge honour and a privilege, I realised that after that, I really was going to be flying the desk and I was never going to have an opportunity where I would command soldiers ever again. And soldiers are brilliant.
On the ground, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I would be thinking about policy. I might be, you know, increasing capability. I might be doing a training role. There were all these different options that were still available to me, but they were never hands-on with soldiers. And I just felt for me that although you can demonstrate and you can use your leadership experience when you're in that kind of role, I wanted to be in a role, even if that meant leaving, that I could use those skills on a day-to-day basis. So I could be leading a team, developing team cohesion, all those things that I had spent 20 years, you know, developing and being able to demonstrate. I wanted to carry on doing that. And I just felt that I was young enough that if I left then, I had opportunities to do something completely different on the outside, but continue to use all of that knowledge.
As you know, we've got lots of old Edwardians that listen to this from both the boys and the girls' school, but we've also got lots of current students who listen to this. Might be deciding, you know, what do I do next with my life? Might be looking at those university choices. I think when it comes to the military, there's so many different. It's almost like we talked about at the beginning, you know, Navy, don't like the sea. Flying, my eyesight isn't good enough, so it's got to be the Army. But then there's so much that you can do within that organization, isn't there? You know, it's not just you become one type of soldier that, you know, in terms of the military police, what's the difference, would you say, between the kind of, because it's almost its own separate section of the military, isn't it, the military police?
Well, the army has all sorts of different cap badges. So you could be an engineer, you could be in the artillery, you could be in the infantry, you could be doing an administrative role. And the military police is just another one of those. But I think certainly as an officer, one of the things that's important to note is that you come into role and out of role regularly. So you move sort of appointments every 2 or 3 years, but you will fluctuate between having a specialist military police role or a specialist cap badge role, depending on what trade group you've chosen, and then into a more general army post. So that, you know, in a number of different so for example, going to Sandhurst as a platoon commander training instructor was one of those roles. I didn't need to be military police to do that. It could be any cap badge in the army. So for me, that variety was brilliant. You know, it wasn't until I got to be a commanding officer. I spent 2 years, 9 months in that role, and that was the longest time I'd ever spent in one job in 21 years. and that constant change and constantly having to adapt and be flexible in your approach was, you know, it was challenging, but really enjoyable. And maybe that explains a lot of the problems I've had since leaving, because just trying to sit still and stay in one place for any length of time, it's not really in my DNA.
So what kind of things were you doing then? I mean, I'm sure there's lots of things that you can't tell me about your day-to-day in your 21 years.
I suppose the most interesting ones would be straight out of Sandhurst, going out to Kosovo and helping collect evidence for the prosecution of war crimes. So I was sort of 24 when I was doing that. So that was really, really interesting. I went to Iraq in 2003, crossed the border with my team. And when we operate overseas, we also operate on behalf of the UK coroner. So you become the delegated coroner's officer essentially overseas. And so we were involved in investigations where we had loss of life of UK service personnel and serious incidents. So, you know, that was a really difficult time, but, you know, really important to know that there's a family at the end of all of those situations that are looking for answers. So it's a really, really important role. I spent another operational tour in Afghanistan and was responsible for closing down the detention facilities and detention pathway where we'd previously handed detainees over to the Afghan system. So some fascinating things. And then obviously becoming a CEO and then being responsible for investigating all sorts of, you know, incidents and investigations across the world, wherever UK service personnel might be deployed, and also on occasion their families. Now, a lot of offending within the military environment tends to be offences against the person. So there will be fighting and assaults, a lot of it generated by alcohol, a lot of sexual assaults as well. So, yeah, a wide variety. And then, you know, there's the burglary, there's the theft, there's all sorts of things that happen. So a real wide range of experience.
Would you mind if we talked about war crimes and just the definition of, just because, as you say, we're recording this on the 7th of March, it's International Women's Day tomorrow. Of course, another big thing that's going on in the world around us right now is that Russia have invaded Ukraine. And war crime seems to be the current narrative in the media. Are war crimes being committed in Ukraine? What is the definition of a war crime for someone who doesn't know? Because obviously war is war. War is grotesque. War is horrible, and so many bad things will happen in war. But that is just what war is. But there are rules to war, aren't there? Kind of international rules to how you conduct warfare.
Yeah, there's the international law of armed conflict, but and so the definitions of war crimes are really quite narrow. And so I think, you know, it's really important for people to understand the terminology and to be really careful about how they use that. Interestingly, I was reflecting on this yesterday because when I studied at Aberystwyth, I was doing international politics and international history, and I actually wrote my undergraduate dissertation on Rwanda, bearing in mind that I was at university from 93 to 97. So it literally just happened, and thought, gosh, I can see that this conflict in Ukraine is going to be the subject of its living history, and it's fascinating. And, you know, things like the prosecutions at the for the former Yugoslavia, the special tribunals were going on for years and years afterwards. So I think, you know, it's a really, really difficult thing to do. It's a really difficult in terms of even in Iraq, how we defined combatants and non-combatants. And we're not in a generation where we have clear fighting on both sides. So if, you know, you take
World War II, is that they're not in uniform, you know.
Exactly. So, you know, if you're in the Second World War, people were clearly identifiable, whether they were a combatant or they were non-combatant and civilian. And, you know, we've seen already that in this current conflict that's not easily definable. And particularly when you have lots of, you know, civilian volunteering and being sort of conscripted or volunteering into the sort of reserve forces or the civilian defence force. How does that change the terminology and the definition within the law? And so it's a really, really complex area. We could do an entire podcasts on it, but I think that we're going to see some far-reaching consequences of it. And I think that there's going to be, you know, clearly there's obviously already people making some quite strong cases to say that, you know, there should be, you know, prosecution taken after this. And it's without having all the facts, it's really difficult to say what that looks like and how it might materialise in the future. But it's just, I mean, it's really difficult.
Will that be happening now then? It's not something that is, you know, reflected on down the line. People will be gathering evidence now.
They will be. Yeah, absolutely. Because evidence needs to be fresh. But of course, we're still in a different conflict in that, you know, things have moved on so much in terms of, you know, the way we use cyber, the manipulation of the media. You know, you're seeing all sorts of things on Twitter now about people hacking into different systems and how that might work. And so, you know, warfare is just conducted in a very different way. And it has, you know, it has developed exponentially over the last 20 years. And methodology and approaches that we might have used in the 80s and 90s, you know, are very different now. And so as a consequence, as investigators, you need to understand the world in a different way and know where to look and how, you know, what forensic opportunities may be available to you in different environments, whether that be sort of digital and technology versus what we might have done previously. So, yeah, it's a ever-evolving thing at the moment.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Bedu, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
Can we talk then about your current role? You are the Global Head of Special Investigations at GSK Consumer Healthcare. First of all, what's GSK? Because it's something that people probably would have seen a lot in terms of the red letters on the side of different buildings. But what is GSK?
GlaxoSmithKline, so pharmaceutical and healthcare company. So it has a number of divisions that's in, sit with it. It's UK based, but obviously global multinational. So at the moment, I'm working within the consumer healthcare side. So you may have seen in the press that we are demerging in the summer from GSK, and the pharmaceuticals, the vaccine side will remain as new GSK, and I'll be going across to consumer healthcare, which is going to be listed in July, known as Haleon, which is great. We just literally launched that or announced that last week. And so our side of the business is very much sort of over-the-counter type products, some really big global brands that you will know. So Advil, Panadol, Sensodyne, ChapStick, you know, all of these household names which will are part of the business. But wherever you have a multinational organization, you have internal investigations, allegations, complaints that come up. And so my role at the moment is to create that team, not only for investigations, but also for security and resilience across all of our markets, so that as the company then launches in the summer, we're in a position to make sure that we can deal with any allegations or concerns that come in.
And are these allegations, so internally, or people, consumers, for example, making allegations against GSK, or
both? It can be both. It can be both. So, yeah, it's open to anyone to follow our speak up procedures. So that could be internal employees, or it could be, like you say, a consumer or a healthcare professional that might be wanting to make or raise a concern with us. So, yeah, it's widely available to anybody that wanted to register any kind of concern.
So there's some similarities, of course, to your former career, but I imagine very different day to day.
Yeah, it is different in the sense that obviously in the sort of corporate environment, we're not in the business of necessarily that sort of that criminal mindset. So there are some obviously things that we deal with where, you know, offences may have been committed, but a lot of it will also be just internal concerns that may come up. It may be a lack of control or monitoring in a certain area. It could be a concern about counterfeit goods, all of these sorts of things, which, you know, but there's a huge correlation in terms of the skill set that I had previously and how I can bring that. And again, it's creating a team, it's leading a team, and those skills easily move between different environments.
Is it a very different environment, though, big corporate to military? Did you find leaving the military, because obviously that's been your whole career, did you find it a difficult process to move from military
really
to corporate?
Really tough. Yeah, and bearing in mind I left the military in October 19, so in hindsight, terrible timing. If I'd have known that there was a global pandemic 6 months around the corner, then maybe I wouldn't have left at the time that I did. But I describe my transition as when you're in the military, you wear a uniform and you wear a badge of rank. And that rank isn't necessarily about, oh, look at me, aren't I great? I've reached this particular, rank in my career. It's about an instantly recognisable identifier of experience. So I can look at you in your uniform, look at your rank slide, and I can go, okay, to be that rank, she must have X number of years experience roughly, which means she's probably done this, that, and the other. And therefore, if I ask her about something, I know that she's probably going to be able to contribute and offer me a view. And suddenly you take that uniform off and it's like being naked. So you've had this time where you've been part of something that is bigger than the sum of its parts. It has its own culture. You have that sense of belonging. And it's also your identity, or I thought it was. So I thought I was, well, I'm Jules and I'm the army officer, not, well, I'm Jules and this is who I am and who I stand for. And suddenly that disappeared overnight. And I had to work really hard to try and understand who I was underneath all of that. And without that uniform, you know, what were my values? You know, where were my ethics? Where did I draw the line? What was I really passionate about? And therefore, what environment did I want to work in? And when I first left, I went to work for a small business. And bearing in mind the conversation we had previously about women and being in the minority, that was all I'd ever known, that male-dominated environment. And that makes you probably, rightly or wrongly, behave in a certain way to be able to feel that your presence is being felt. And then I went to work for this small business where 20 out of the 21 employees were female. And I really struggled with it because I just didn't feel like I fitted in. And I do hold myself accountable for some of that. I'm not sure whether the way that I approached it, the way that I presented myself, was maybe they didn't really know how to deal with me. And so it was a really tricky time. And a week before the pandemic, I decided that it wasn't the right environment for me and I wanted to move on and do something else. And so I chose to move on. But then, of course, we went into lockdown. And so that was really, really a difficult time. And I then went to work for Ricoh for a few months. And again, more learning, but that was completely virtual. How do you, lots of conversations now about hybrid working, but how do you start a new role? How do you, demonstrate to other people what it is that you're capable of when you don't even know how tall they are? I met them once and I remember one of my colleagues saying, oh, by the way, just to let you know, I'm 5'2" and I get the impression you're probably taller than me. I just thought the irony, because you've never been in that situation before. That was really strange. And then that was lasted for a few months. And then I went across and I worked for Amazon for 12 months before finally settling at GSK. And the thing for me was very much its culture. I wanted to be working in an environment where the culture of the organisation and the values that the organisation had really chimed with me. And, moving forward, when we launched as a separate company in July, we're all about creating everyday, better everyday health. And so that's really important. You know, when you've got a set of values which are about keeping it human and doing the right thing and going above and beyond, that chimes with who I am and what I wanted to do. So
it takes you back to your gap year in the middle of that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
finally kind of found my fit. And I suppose, and then if I, I supplement that with what I do in my volunteering role, because it goes back to the gap year, it goes back to sixth form about there always being something more and always feeling that you want to be a force for good, which sounds really trite, but actually I think I genuinely believe that.
That doesn't sound trite at all. I mean, speaking of that, the time that you've had to think about your own values and who you are, because I think that's such an interesting, obviously the military is such an established organisation, and there's certain ways of doing things, and it's been done that way for a long time, and there's very good reasons and huge traditions to it, and this weight of history that comes with that. And of course, you know, you have the opportunity to be the individual within that organisation, but are you very different to who you thought you were then, having had that time to reflect and to look at those values? I suppose the question is, can an organisation really shape who you are and how you behave?
I think the first no, the second yes. So I right. don't think they can necessarily shape who you are, but I think they can definitely influence how you behave, because there's, you know, there's a set of rules that sit, and that doesn't matter which organisation you work for. That's not just the military. You know, it could be a big corporate, you know, things that you can and can't say in public or talk about different issues. So I do think that there is a constraint there, but I think it's probably more in the military than it is outside. I think I'd never really had to do that self-awareness work before. I think I probably knew, and the answers that I came up with weren't necessarily earth-shattering to me, but being forced to write it in black and white does allow you to examine it. And then actually you can pull out those sort of characteristics and think, well, which ones do I want to dial up? Which ones matter enough for me to look for a role in an organization that allows those to come to the fore versus others that may not have quite as much importance for you on a daily basis? So, you know, I've really certainly having over the last 2 years, finding an organization with the right culture for me has been absolutely key.
I've been doing it myself over the last few years for a very different reason. Obviously, yours is a big change in the way that you spend your 9-to-5s. For me, it was giving up alcohol. And I know it's completely different, but it's been over 18 months for me now. And it's really kind of, I don't know, it's made me want to think about what... I'd never thought about my values before. I'd never thought, actually, what are the bits that... Why do I get out of bed in the morning? What's my reason for doing stuff? And I'd never thought about that until that kind of... Cloud. I mean, I wasn't I wasn't a problem drinker, but I was drinking enough for it to be something that just never entered my consciousness. It was always just a bit of a kind of hazy cloud, and I've got this clarity now that I've never had before. I wish that we did this work earlier. I wish that we could do this when we were 17, 18 and really think, who am I and what do I believe in and why do I feel that way?
But also knowing that that also evolves, and then in parallel to that, I think what we would describe them as superpowers. So everybody has a number of superpowers where actually they're types of behavior that, you know, really characterize what's special about you. And they can change over time because you can learn different skills, and in different environments, you may be amplifying those or not. But I think you're right. It's work that we need to start doing when we're much younger. But I also think it needs to be it's almost like a live document, isn't it? Something that you continuously need to sort of re-examine, because, you know, things can change. Things happen to people and their values will change as a result of that.
Absolutely.
You know, I think, you know, the pandemic, what's happening in Ukraine, all of those things will make us re-examine what's important to us as individuals. You know, and my other half is still serving and has been away for 9 months. And it really does make you sort of sit back and realise, well, what actually is important? You know, I need to then make more emphasis on sort of that work-life balance at the moment, because he's not here, so I'm parenting for two. You know, all of those kind of things that, you know, they will change depending on your circumstances.
So you sound incredibly busy. Obviously, you're working, GSK, you're a mom, but you've also got this volunteer role. Is it a volunteer role being the chair of the... You're the chair of British wheelchair basketball. I mean, how do you find the time?
Well, with difficulty sometimes, I have to admit. So as I was leaving the army, I had an opportunity. So I was really keen to get a board role. I wanted to be able to give something back as an independent director. Sports seemed like the obvious way to go. And by choosing British wheelchair basketball, it also, my daughter was born profoundly deaf. So, you know, disability is something that is, that I'm really passionate about. So opportunities and inclusiveness for everybody.
And so I joined the board and then a year later became the chair. So I've been the chair now since summer 20. It's such a small organisation, but it packs a really powerful punch. I don't know whether you've ever seen wheelchair basketball, but oh my goodness, it's brutal. And I think from my rugby kind of background and enjoying those physical sports, seeing something like that is just incredible. And the Commonwealth Games, which obviously coming home to Birmingham in the summer, hugely exciting. And they're playing outdoors. So yeah, anyone who's listening, get along to a game because you will really, really enjoy it.
And how are we looking? What are our chances?
Well, you see, this is quite challenging for me because as the national governing body, we're also responsible for Team England. But as I said before, obviously, as a proud Welsh woman, that becomes a little bit challenging. So I have to remain strictly neutral on this, but I think it's looking good. You can read into that what you like.
So your passion for sport did actually start at KEHS. And, well, I mean, maybe before that, but there was one teacher in particular, wasn't there, that kind of really ignited that flame inside you?
Yeah, absolutely. So Liz Evans, who was absolutely incredible, total inspiration and has remained my sort of, you know, icon for all things sport. So she just really helped us as a team and as an individual. She's so passionate about what she was doing and we all really respected and looked up to her. And I was really lucky to be able to reconnect with her recently and it was fabulous to catch up. And I don't think she necessarily realised what a huge impact she had on a generation of young girls. Truly inspirational.
The best teachers often don't, do they?
No, absolutely.
They have absolutely no idea of the. I mean, can you trace it back? Like, can you say that you know, obviously you've achieved so much with sport. Can you trace that back to Liz Evans? If she'd not been there, would things have been different?
I think so. And I think because for me, when she was coaching our hockey team and she made me the captain, it was not just about playing the sport and those particular skills that I was having to learn. She taught me how to lead. And I think that if I think about my leadership journey, no matter the context, doing that as a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old on the sports field and her influence over that absolutely has shaped my career, both on and off the sports pitch for the rest of the last 30 years. So definitely.
This leads very nicely into the last question that I ask everybody on this podcast, which is, what characteristic would you say has served you best since leaving school? And it can be something that was developed at KHS. It doesn't have to be. But yeah, not a person, not a qualification. What characteristic would you say served you best?
Oh, gosh, there are several. But I think I would probably, if I had to pick one, and we talked at the beginning about me not being the academic genius that many of my classmates were. But I think it's given me a sense of, I would call it, humble excellence. That ability to always sort of have relentless pursuit of your goals, but of achieving everything that you do at the highest possible level, but doing it with a degree of humility. And if you put those together, I think for me, that would be one of my superpowers. And I think school gave me that.
I mean, we don't have to limit it to just one. If there's other superpowers that you'd love to talk about.
I think that's just dogged determination of just, you know, or just following your goals and that, you know, relentless pursuit. And it taught me that because I was never top of the class, I had to keep going and I had to keep achieving. And so I've continued to do that. I've always been looking for that next opportunity. How can I learn? How can I grow? How can I add value? And I think that's what has led me through my military career to the current roles that I hold today and will continue to do so.
Jules Park Robinson, thank you ever so much for your time today, for spending so much time with me. I know we've talked about so much. It's been great. It's been lovely to meet you. So thanks for coming on Ed Talks.
You're welcome. Lovely to meet you, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you for for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.